This country's not going to be saved from the top, because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. A start for a new season, season 2023. This is Arnie Lukes here at the Crossroads, and I'd like to welcome my two special guests from the other side of the world, from Canada. Welcome, Wallace Klink.
Well, pleased to be here, Arnie. I'm really delighted to be with you again.
No worries. Pleased to have you back, Wally, and in renewed health. It's absolutely wonderful to have you on the show. And welcome, Robert Klink.
Good to see you again, Arnie. Hope you had a pleasant break. Got some Christmas cheer and a positive attitude toward the new year. And let's hope that that will carry through into our experience of that year.
No worries.
Not always looking bright, but there are opportunities everywhere. And even though there are people who think they can control everything, they can't, because reality is more complex than they understand. They will have their setbacks.
Exactly right. And my attitude towards that is, yes, we are relying on divine intervention. We are relying on it. We are hoping for it. We are praying for it, that God will assist us in our endeavors to pursue freedom. To pursue freedom in a moral and responsible environment, and I think that that's just in my mind, it's a wonderful thing, and it has all of the potential, potential of a life more abundant. And you think, here it is, the situation is such that there's the war in Europe, there is the supply line threat, there is the damage, the physical damage that has been already done to people and their bodies through the jab. And of course, then you've got the manipulation of the crops. You've got massive manipulation of the sciences. And of course, building on that, you've also got the massive manipulation, the psychological manipulation of the media, the mainstream media. But it's not only the mainstream media, it is also a good measure of the alternative media. That the alternative media presents a very carefully scripted, managed dissent. And so there's not a clear line of demarcation between what is true, what is moral, what is right, and where we should go. And I think that our understanding has to actually pursue more vigorously truth. We have to actually look to God more closely as to how his kingdom operates, and then seek this kingdom, and all these things will be added unto you. So on the basis of that introduction, Wally Klink, I'll give you the floor.
Oh, well, you're putting the onus on me in a hurry here. I think that we sweat too much over things because we really don't have faith and belief, confidence in our position in this universe. What are we? Why are we? And what are we doing here? What is expected of us? Is anything expected of us? If it is, what is it? I think that we, if you look at nature, I don't think the average creature in nature spends a lot of time fretting about what he or she should be doing. I think they're just simply living a natural life. I think that is the way things were meant to be. We weren't meant to be questioning everything we do and questioning everything that happens that doesn't happen in this world. Yes, we're supposed to explore the universe, but we shouldn't be constantly uncertain as to what our purpose is and what we should be doing. I think it's a natural way of living. And that natural way of living is simply that. At least that's what the scriptures say. Say that we simply don't have to fret and worry about everything all the time. But if we don't believe in God, if we don't believe in the divine power, then of course we have a problem. We have an unresolved problem. Anyway, that's the way I look at it. I think we should spend more time being natural.
Okay. Thank you for that, Wally. And you've opened up an interesting thought process, because this question of the natural instinctive nature of things, I think about, say, beasts of the field, and I think birds of the air and all those sorts of things, and they instinctively do things. They instinctively do things, and they go to a tree and they'll strip it of its fruit and all that sort of stuff, or the seeds, or they'll lick the nectar out of the flower. So they do, and God does provide. But also during droughts and other things, pestilence, they suffer. And so it is man has looked at that and he's gone past just doing things instinctively, and he's actually built storehouses and things like that so that the crops can be harvested and saved for a rainy day. And that way he takes into account the swings and the roundabouts. Now, at the moment in Australia, certain parts of Australia are going through flooding, and of course that has affected some crops. But the rain on the periphery has actually caused an abundance of harvest in other areas that don't normally produce as much. So it seems as if the overall production is fairly sustainable, fairly reliable, and that in itself is good. But it is because he accommodates, he takes into account variabilities and, of course, the changes of the season. So he takes into account these things, looking for a practical solution. Anyway, your thoughts, please, Robert Klink.
Well, Wally was talking about people fretting all the time. You know, I'm not sure they fret enough, because so many people just want to go with the flow. And the flow has taken us into a perilous position, because it's obvious that there is a world plot to strip people of their assets and of their freedoms. And so there has to be serious thought about these things. There has to be serious analysis of the processes whereby people are being deprived of their assets and freedoms. And if there isn't understanding, there can't be a defense against this. So I'm not sure about just living naturally. I mean, the people who developed the process for producing steel, and the people who mined metals, and the scientists who worked in, you know, for whole lifetimes in laboratories to give us the processes that enable us to have the wonderful materials we have now. In many cases, they were, I guess, motivated by love. They were motivated by a confidence in the capacity of their environment to give them things beneficial for humanity. But it wasn't spontaneous. It involved a lot of study and effort and cooperation in many areas. So while I think the fundamental attitude that we are living in a world of potential abundance is essential, and if we have the benefits of that abundance, we absolutely should be bathed in gratitude for it, because it's a wonderful thing. We're not responsible for the resources that we've been able to exploit in order to improve our lives, but those resources are there for us to use creatively. And it's human agents who have done this to a great extent. There's a natural push toward abundance in nature, I think, but human beings have to take hold of that and make use of it in a beneficial way. And I think it's essential also that they should make use of it in a way that takes the well-being of their neighbors into account. You're saying, Arnie, if productivity is affected negatively in one area, well, it seems as if it goes up in others. Well, in order for people to benefit from that, they're going to have to be oriented toward assisting each other. In other words, loving each other. And this is a key foundation of a society. If that isn't there, I think a society is doomed to fail. But it is there. It is there in most societies. But there's an overlay of people whose ambition it is to control everything. And so that is a situation that has to be recognized and dealt with. And we can see that the attempt to control people is getting more and more ambitious. You know, this COVID business and now the conversion to digital money so that every transaction you do will be surveyed. And if you get out of line, you can be canceled monetarily. I mean, these are serious issues. And we have to find practical ways of averting those developments. So as I said in a previous broadcast, I think there's a kind of dance that we're in a dance with divinity and we're in a dance with our fellow men, and we should all be doing it in a way that promotes cooperation and coordination and successful enterprise in all respects. Success being measured by the fact that all people are benefiting from the potential prosperity of our good earth.
Yeah, beautifully put. Thank you for that, Robert. You've certainly opened up some thinking in my mind as to that dance, especially the illustration of the dance, because it's to me the physical act of dancing is that it is something that is quite spontaneous, unless you're seriously choreographed or something like that. But generally, dancing amongst people is spontaneous, and a husband and wife, my wife and I did some training around the time of our wedding. And it was beautiful. And of course, don't tell me that I had the steps in my mind as to what I was going to do. Nothing like it. It really was spontaneous. But the thing is that I can only ever be spontaneous if I'm given sufficient freedom to make those choices. And for instance, in say in our home or in the garden or in our current environment, the studio environment, the ability to make differing choices. Now, I'm going to talk about this because I think it's important to consider. The backdrop that you can see behind me is my brother's trailer. And if you look carefully above the trailer, you'll see some glints of flying insects, and that's some beehives that are there. And the point is that this spontaneity of shifting our studio outdoors and making it mobile is a dance. It's actually a dance of choice, of choosing to do something different, of going in a different direction. Now, we've got, I saw it on UK Column just yesterday, was in regard to a study being done at Monash University in Victoria, about 500 mile from here, 450, 500 mile. And that study was about smart cities. And it's about actually limiting people. It's about controlling people. It's about using smart meters, smart devices, and also restricting movement. And all of these things are essentially imposing a straitjacket onto a city, onto a smart city. Now, Adelaide, in the area of Salisbury, is choosing to impose this same type of smart city model. And so what we're going to experience is a different way of living. Now, this isn't spontaneous. This is actually part of a long-term plan, a plan of control. Very, very important to recognize, as you said, Robert, that others are out there and they are attempting to plan every facet of everything that you do, to monitor you and to reward or punish you. This is communism on steroids. And this is what is happening in a local government area near you in supposedly a free nation of Australia. Once free, no longer free. Now, since COVID, since the lockdown, I declared in 3 years ago, in about March, I declared that Australia had a coup and that our legitimate government was overrun, it was overruled, and that we had a new form of government, even though some players were the same players. We had Scott Morrison as Prime Minister, and he immediately established the National Cabinet, which bridged across all parliaments in Australia, the National Cabinet, so that decisions could be made by National Cabinet, no Hansard, no recording of the conversations, no recording of the votes or the determinations or the processes or anything like that, and that all governments in Australia were going to abide by National Cabinet imposing World Health Organization policy over all of Australia. That's what happened nearly 3 years ago. We've experienced that. Smart cities is a continuation of that whole concept of control. And the question is, if we are to want to dance, to still want to dance, how do we go about bringing that ability, that capacity to restore our freedom, our ancient rights and freedoms, and restore the integrity and the inviolability, if you like, of our constitution? Because our constitution is being completely ignored. Our parliaments, our parliamentary procedures are being completely ignored to impose world government policy through the World Health Organization or through world trade agreements, which number in their thousands. And this is being imposed on us. And so it's no longer democracy. It's no longer representative government. It's actually totalitarian government in the form of this coup. And the coup, you can't put names to faces. You just need to recognize that the once what were representative politicians are no more. All they are is administrators. They're essentially have agreed or will agree to manage world government policy better than the other lot. And that's all that we're experiencing. Now, virtually every state, and certainly federally, we've had our elections and we've changed governments, but nothing has changed. The policy is still exactly the same. One of totalitarianism, one of imposition, where we're not free to dance. We're not free to take our own personal road on our life of discovery. But we have to do as we're told, as is imposed, or we will have these fears, these punishments imposed on us. And this is what the smart cities are about. This is what central bank digital currency is all about. This is what the cameras and the microphones being placed everywhere is about. This is what smart devices are all about. It's about monitoring you. It's about making life increasingly, increasingly difficult for you in order for you to actually exercise your inherent rights, your ancient freedoms that go back time immemorial. 1100, the Coronation Charter was a pushback against tyranny. 1215 was Magna Carta, which was a further pushback against tyranny. So we've got to consider these things in the light of our current circumstances. There was a pushback, and it took a serious commitment from the barons to push back the tyranny of King John in 1215. But that continued on until 1295. That pushback continued on. It wasn't just a one-off event. it took generations, it took lifetimes in actual fact to work it through from 1100 till 1295, until the Magna Carta was written into the common law. And this is where we are. This is where we are, viewers, I'm afraid. The truth of it is that the United Nations, that this central world government controlled by central banks wants to control every facet of your life. And you have to actually make a deliberate choice to push back. You have to exercise your ancient rights and freedoms and demonstrate them and reinforce it amongst your community as best as you're able. Now, I'm going to bring you back on again, Robert, because we've got an ailing host there, and so we've just got to work our way through. Your thoughts, please, Robert Klink.
Well, things have moved along a bit since the days of King John, I'm afraid, because we've got all this technology now, and he could impose his will with, brute force, ultimately. But the world we're entering now is, it might be characterized by brute force. I'm sure it will be for dissenters. And in fact, you know, people, some of the theoreticians of this have said, Julian Huxley, I think, wrote a book in which he said, we will recruit the best brains of the young people, and we will, I think he said that we're able to convince them that snow is black. They will do this to people's minds. And he said, if there are some extraordinarily bright young people who just can't be brought along to see things our way, we'll have to physically eliminate them. Now, I'm not saying that this is necessarily what's envisaged right now, but it has been envisaged by some pretty major thinkers of the 20th century. So we shouldn't assume that everything is always going to be, say, as gentle as it is now. And it's certainly not gentle for many people who are suffering deprivation and terrible worry about the welfare of their families. You know, now you can have your children removed from you in some instances if you resist their implanted wish to change their gender or something like this. It's really getting to be a frightening society we're living in. But talk about the capacities of government to control people. It is now recognized in the U.S. government that the government is legally entitled to lie to the population. Well, I think this is quite a denial of the principle of representation. It's the same thing in the UK. The UK just went through the adoption of a whole succession of laws in which they gave specific organizations, largely ones with sort of policing functions, the ability to lie to the population so they can set up, you know, traps, supposedly for criminals. But it doesn't say it's only directed against criminals. It's directed against anybody that the government decides should be deceived. So we've got to the point where it is now legally acceptable for governments to lie to their populations. This is intolerable. And if people had any sort of surveillance capacity over their governments, they would never tolerate this. But the legislation has actually gone through. And so they can set up traps for people. You know, if you're a difficult citizen, they can arrange for you to have troubles that will sideline you in your resistance to government abuse. So, you know, what did Stalin say? Stalin said, show me the man and I'll show you the crime. Well, that is the society we're about to enter into. I mean, I think we've been in it to a degree for a long time. A lot of people who were trying to reform society in to the benefit of their fellow citizens have been attacked by government agents just because they are seen as impediments to the power structure. So what can we do about this? You know, we were talking about this before the broadcast, and it struck me that we have to come up with some way of enhancing social cohesion in a clear-minded way so that people understand the necessity of supporting each other, because the powers that be want us to be atomized. They want us to be isolated from each other. And this is, I mean, they're proceeding with this in a very aggressive way. And it's something that our only hope of overcoming it is through associating and understanding that we have an obligation to our fellow man, because we believe in the principle of love. And this, I really think, is our only hope. I was wondering if we shouldn't have some sort of new concept of society, is that a society with a title like Society for the Enhancement of Social Cohesion for the Protection of Society Against evildoers. I mean, because that's what we're facing right now. It's something that people could identify with, that would also be sort of an education for them. So if you felt you were a member of that group with that orientation, you would more readily come to the assistance of your fellows. I mean, people are inclined to come to their assistance of their fellows anyway, but I think to make it more conscious would be of great benefit. And as I say, if we're just particles with no common interests, no cooperative spirit, then they'll just pick us off one by one. The troublemakers will be dealt with, and the others will just go with the flow, as they say. So to propose a practical solution to this, I'm not sure. I think one thing that has to be overcome is the instinctive confidence people have had in their institutions. You know, they've thought they're living in a democracy and they can always change the government. I mean, this is a really clever device that they've used in the past, because if you were unhappy with your government, which inevitably came about, then you could throw the rotters out and bring in a new crew. But unfortunately, this has always resulted in the new crew being, after a few years, equivalent to the old crew. So it's just an endless succession of throwing politicians out of power because you're dissatisfied with them. But it's hardly a way for people to control their political institutions. It's in fact a way that had been developed by I don't know who's responsible for this, corporate powers, financial powers. I think personally it's something above those. Those are things we can see. But we have to bring people together in a spirit of joint cause in such a way that they will exert pressure, irresistible pressure, on politicians. But they have to realize that the old way of merely voting for a new crew doesn't work, because there's too much opportunity for suborning and bribing and all sorts of control devices that can be brought against that small number of people who are developing your laws. There has to be some kind of active flow of influence from the population onto those institutions. It was in the original idea of representative government, but that's gone by the boards. And the idea that particularly elected politicians think of themselves as there to represent the will of their electors. I mean, they pay lip service to this by communicating with them on a regular basis through the mail, but it's not the way they think, and it's not the way the system operates. So I really think that an effort must be made to enhance social cohesion, to give people a sense of common cause and a sense that they are a community. And this is another thing that's been under attack, you know, through disruption of sort of established cultural entities and that sort of thing. It's well, that's a bit of rambling there. I hope there were some ideas that would be something that people might take up and advance, but it's we're faced with a really daunting problem right now because our institutions have failed so badly, and our constitutions, which were supposed to be our basic protections against the kind of abuse that's going on now, have been undermined. They're not practiced anymore.
No worries. Thank you so much for that, Robert. You actually brought up, to my mind, you brought up three major thoughts. The first is I wanted to talk about Sidney Powell. Now, when the 2020 election, federal presidential election, went through and the result was clear, Sidney Powell was one of those who was on the rostrum with Donald Trump. And I think it's Rudy Giuliani or whatever, the mayor of New York, I think. Anyway, Sidney Powell went on to defend the Republic. And she's done, in my mind, an absolutely sterling job of being honest, of being faithful, and of being true to the ideals of representative government. And as a woman, I just honestly, I am just thrilled with what she has done, what she is continuing to do. Now, in the course of the January 6th investigation, she gave evidence. And in that evidence, I think it was like 176 pages of evidence, she makes a few salient points. The first is that, and this is vitally important, that in the 2000 election, George Bush, Al Gore were both vying for president. It was actually a corruption of the voting system through the electronic counting that the Republicans were able to achieve the presidency. And so what they did, the Republicans were actually using, illegitimately, they were using subversive means in order to swing the election their way. Now, Sidney Powell testified for the January 6th that since that time, the Democrats didn't complain about it. They were frustrated because Al Gore was, instead of being the president of choice of the people, Al Gore lost it. But Al Gore was sent on another mission, which was, of course, the climate advocate. But the Democrats themselves, what they did was they investigated how the Republicans had subverted that election, to the point where they became masters of their own, if you like, masters of that particular system, of the subversion of that system. So they worked it through to conclusion, and of course the last 2022 presidential election, 2020 presidential election, Joe Biden was successful because they manipulated and controlled the election processes through the electronics intervention and algorithms and things like that. Very, very important, her testimony to January 6th. In other words, both political parties are into it, up to their necks. They're into corruption. They're into the perversion of the voting process, the electoral process, and they were pursuing their own agenda. And of course, that's still, I mean, it's still coming out. The news is slowly emerging, but it's actually her testimony to me that is most important, because the because from that, of course, you come to the point, well, can you actually trust the vote? Can you legitimately trust the vote? And that's a huge question mark. Now, Amy McGrath in Australia during the 1990s, the late 1990s, she was investigating the electoral processes in Australia. She's passed now, but we're fortunate that we hold her books, and I believe some of them are on in PDF, and you may find them in our library. Very, very important to reinforce that Australia is not out of the woods. Australia is not out of the woods at all. And in actual fact, our election processes are under just as big a cloud as it is with America. So we've really got to take stock of that. That if the point of trying to vote our way out of this situation is not an easy point at all. It's not an easy point. It's particularly difficult, and we've got to work it through one step at a time, recognizing that we may not have one is a clear cut result. We may not have a legitimate bona fide expression of the people's will. All these sorts of things are very, very important. So talking about the election processes, and of course Amy McGrath, who was investigating what was going on in Australia. Very, very important. Very, very important. I hope you're recording, Claude. Yeah, Amy McGrath's work was very important, because what it did was it set the stage to show that the interference in the electoral process was not is not something new. This has been going on. This has been going on for generations, and it's been going on because the question of power is so great. The question of power, this the idea of actually being able to govern a country, to make the laws to your own advantage, it is so attractive. And so the question of community responsibility, of individual responsibility, can't be overemphasized. That if you don't participate, if you don't actually engage in the political process, and I don't mean one day every 3 years you happen to do a vote, but if you don't actually engage realistically in the political process, then there's every good chance that the process will be won over by others who have another point of view. And of course, they will be defending their point of view because the stakes are so great. The stakes are so high. And at the moment, we're looking at the stakes are so great that you're looking at world government. This is what's going on. World government wants, they want power over the whole world. And so how are you as an individual going to wrestle that power back off world government so that you can actually exercise your right to dance your dance? Now, I came across, so kudos to Sydney Powell and the work that she's doing. I receive her email, her website, Defending the Republic, is very good. defendingtherepublicpac.com. That's the actual URL to it. Her work is, honestly, I'm just so impressed with the integrity and the perseverance, the tenacity of that woman in what she's doing. And if we have a few more of her types in Australia, then all the better for Australia. Now, there was a book that I came across, and it's called The Nameless War. And I wanted to talk about that because at the time of the Second World War, the initiation of the Second World War, Captain Ramsay, who was a member of the British Parliament, he was a member of the British Parliament. He was an elected representative. And at the time of the starting of hostilities for the Second World War, he was immediately incarcerated and he stayed in prison. He was kept in prison without charge, without trial, without anything for the duration of hostilities of the Second World War. And as a consequence of that, he chose to write this book, The Nameless War. I think it is an excellent read because what it does is it lays down the timeline of events that have transpired since the 1600s as all being part of the same pursuit of power, the same policy of pursuit of world government power. That's what he has actually documented. It's a 100-page book. I think the version on the web is maybe 50-something. I've actually got a copy of the book somewhere. I started to reading it, and it is mind-blowing. It is a very strong book. It's not easy to digest. This is serious, heavy food to take into account of what's actually going on. So I think that to me is important, that that you actually consider how important it is to read books of this nature to give you an idea of what's actually transpiring. Very, very important. And the third point that Robert, you did remind me of, was a little booklet that is written by, amongst others, David Mitchell, Dr. David Mitchell, who was a moderator of the Presbyterian Communion. He was a moderator for it, and he was also an international and constitutional lawyer. And I was fortunate to have filmed 5 lectures by David Mitchell. And if you go to our video library front page, you'll see the video library in the navigation bar. If you go to that front page, the video library, you will see the 5 lectures by David Mitchell. And I would encourage you to listen, to view, and to mutter over all of those 5 lectures. Because to me, what he's doing is he's laying the groundwork. He's laying the groundwork of where and how we need to think in order to restore representative in Australia and America, laying the groundwork. And the first point that he makes in lecture 1 in that video library, the first point that he makes there is that the Constitution at the top, that's where he is, those 5 lectures, the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. It is the absolute law of the land. And it's on this basis that all other laws have to abide. And so if a law that's passed by Parliament is unconstitutional, it is the highest court in the land. It's the function of that Constitution to actually ensure that the High Court sits and how it's composed and what it is to determine. And it is the function of the High Court to determine the relationship between that newly passed law and its standing in regard to the supreme law of the land, the Constitution of the Federation of Australia. Very, very important. This is foundational. This is absolutely foundational. And the thing is that when he talks about law, David Mitchell, when he talks about law, he essentially points out, he fundamentally points out that law is based on a philosophy. Law is based on a philosophy. Is man the supreme being, and his knowledge and understanding, is that the beginning and end of all things? Or is God so? And if God is so, then we need to actually consider what God has to say about law and about righteousness and about truth. And all of these facets of framing a constitution, of saying something like that slavery is not only wrong, it's immoral. That one man should have power over another to enslave them. And yet in the likes of, say, communism, in the likes of von Mises libertarianism, slavery is something that's tolerated or actively pursued, that the people of the state are slaves to the state. That is collectivism. And that is similar with von Mises libertarianism, as it is with monopoly capitalism, which is what it is, as it is with communism. They are all one and the same flavor, that slavery is legitimate and acceptable. Now, with this booklet that David Mitchell, that I'm getting to, wrote, Community Controlled Parliaments, and I'm going to actually scan it in and I'm going to place it up with a PDF link so that you can actually share in reading it with me. I've only read the first chapter, but I see it as absolutely fundamental that our education must continue. Our education hasn't stopped with school. Our education continues on, and this pursuit of civics is most, most important. And so we've got to actually work this thing through, this thing called freedom. And it's not something that you can actually just be indifferent towards. It's something that you actually have to actively participate. Now, the Barons of 1215, while it was settled for a time on the field of Runnymede, which essentially was a battleground. I've driven past it. Continue. Because this challenge that's before us to seek the kingdom goes on right to the end. It goes on while we have life, while we draw breath. So, so very, very important. To me, it's the challenge that's of our age. We are of this time. God has placed us in eternity, in this time, because we have the capacity. We don't recognize it, but we do. We have the capacity within ourselves to respond to this situation with every breath we take. And while these may appear bold words, but that's the truth of it. The Christians of their day, 2,000 years ago, they were emboldened at that time. Like the first 30 popes were martyred, something like that. It was absolutely colossal. The first 30 or something popes were martyred for their Christian faith, along with at least a million Christians were put to death because of it.
Well, as I've said before, I think people who are of divine inspiration do not need to sweat over everything. I think that it is something that comes naturally, that would come naturally, and something that is not, it's not Christian in order to sweat it, because if you have faith, there is no need, absolutely no need to sweat these things. They come naturally. It's part of the natural existence. I think that people often take Christianity or take their spiritual values overly serious. And I don't think that is the way or the path to the kingdom. So that's my opinion. I just think that we, if we were really divinely inspired, we don't need to be stressing responsibility at every moment. It just comes. It's part of life. It's part of existence. I think that we're just a little bit too much with ourselves. That's the way I look at it.
No worries. Thank you for that that candid assessment of your point of view, Wally. Very, very important that we carry diverse points of view here, because it's not no one has got a monopoly on truth. And we each have our own calling and our own understanding, and we've got to respect the diverse opinions that are on the floor. Your thoughts, and I'll call for closing comments, please, Robert Clank.
Well, I don't know about this divine inspiration business, because people can become convinced that they're divinely inspired and do some terrible things. you know, like the Puritans, the Calvinists, killing people who were not doing what the elders of the community said they ought to do. A recent example of this was E. Michael Jones, who is quite an intellectual influence in the United States right now. But I listened to a debate he had with a Jewish fellow, actually. And E. Michael Jones says, if God tells you you must kill someone, you have to do it. And I actually agreed with the Jewish fellow who said, well, I hope you don't have any strange dreams in which you get messages that you have to kill people. Because, I mean, people get all sorts of strange notions about their being in communication with God. So are you or are you not? I mean, most people think they're doing good, but they will do the most horrendous things in the pursuit of what their conception of good is. So the practical aspect of this is that you cannot allow individuals to have exaggerated power over society.
Exactly.
They have to be restricted in their, you know, their sphere. And we have these people who aspire now to control everybody's expression of thought and to control their economic opportunities. It's their aspirations are out of all proportion to anything that should be tolerated in a society of love. So you mentioned, I think it was Commander Ramsey in his book. Well, there were a bunch of people. Ramsey was a member of parliament who was incarcerated for the duration of the war. So was Oswald Mosley. He was the head of the fascist party, and therefore he might have come under suspicion as somebody who would be working against the interests of the UK. But as soon as war was declared, he said unequivocally that he would back the British effort in the war against the Germans. He was absolutely clear about that. He was put away for the duration of the war with his wife, and they were put in the most dreadful conditions in prison, and they endured these for the entire length of the war. So these were arbitrary powers that were introduced on the pretext of furthering the war effort. They were an absolute violation of individual freedom. And if you look at them retrospectively, I would say that they were intended less to take dangerous people out of circulation than they were to avoid embarrassment of the government by people who were capable of making objective judgments about things and expressing themselves in a critical way about government policy. So in time of war, this is something that is quite common. And we are in time of war. We're in a war against climate change. We're in a war against apparently a succession of pandemics that are going to be with us for all time. So we have discovered that if you are critical of what government is doing purportedly to pursue these war activities, then you are persona non grata. You can't participate in debate. If you have a career, even an illustrious career as a doctor, you can be decertified. It's extraordinary. So we're in a time when the ability of the individual to pursue his own interests and to express his own opinions is seriously under threat. And it's really a frightening scenario we're going into. And it's imperative that people should recognize the dangers of this, because if they can do it to these people who are putting their heads above the parapet and disagreeing with government policy, then in the end they can do it to you. And almost certainly in the end they will do it to you, because that is the pattern of all these dictatorial systems that have been established in the past. Eventually they get around to everybody, and they deal with them in a rough way, and they suppress their ability to live a life of their own choosing. So these are dangerous times. I mean, in China, they put up overnight steel walls to divide the cities. And the rule was that you could not leave your local neighborhood. This was on the pretext of containing COVID. But it was dreadful. In fact, at certain times, people weren't allowed to leave their residences. And residences in China are largely apartment blocks. In some instances, the authorities welded the doors of the apartment shut. And there was one instance in Xinjiang, the province where the large Muslim population is, where people who were welded into their apartment were incinerated when a fire began. And this is actually what caused the large demonstrations recently in China, because everybody was dreadfully afraid that they were going to be locked in their apartment block. And if somebody starts a fire, they're all going to die in dreadful circumstances. Well, who gave any government official the authority to weld people into their homes? You might think that this is unique to China. Well, I don't think so. In fact, I'm quite convinced that China is the model for the world. China has been an experimental society now for a long time. David Rockefeller, with admiration, said that the Cultural Revolution that killed millions of people in China was the greatest social experiment in human history. He didn't seem to be saying that with disapproval, because it was an ideological transformation of the society. Well, we're going through that right now. We have infiltration of our institutions by trained Marxists. I mean, you might as well say it. It's true. In fact, they've bragged about it, that they are well-trained Marxists. And Marxists are intent on one thing. That's power. They're not intent on loving their fellow citizen. That is something that you find primarily in Christian societies. I think it finds expression in other religious groupings too, and it finds expression even among atheists. They do treat their fellow citizens with respect and kindness, but Marxists do not think that way. And their influence in all Western societies now is very pernicious. They're ensconced in all kinds of positions of power, and this is why everything seems to be going to the devil, because they want it to. If everything goes to the devil, then they have a pretext for establishing their new society. So they encourage something called creative destruction. They want to tear down everything that exists because they are convinced that they have a better way. Well, there's a lot of good that has existed. And if it's all going to be torn down, the future is dark indeed. So it's most imperative that people somehow get the control over their institutions again. They're acting in a completely irresponsible and oppressive way. And this has happened so quickly. The preparations for it have been going on for a long time. I was in university in the 1960s, and I can tell you that every one of my professors in history, with the possible exception of one, was a Marxist. I went to see them in their offices, and this was made very clear to me. So particularly the educational institutions have been subject to subversion for a very long time. And of course, the implantation of these ideas in the students' minds is naive students don't know the ultimate outcome of their adoption of these ideas. Well, now they've gone into positions of influence in society. And something must be done about this. And I think it is, as I said earlier, necessary for a new form of social cohesion and recognition of your participation in society in a loving attitude toward your fellow citizens and a sense of responsibility toward them. You have a sense of, you have responsibility for yourself, but your responsibility doesn't end there, despite the effort to create a totally narcissistic society through the social platforms and that sort of thing. But somehow there has to be a regeneration of this social cohesion. And with that, there would be some hope of bringing about a regeneration of our institutions. But without it, I just don't see. Maybe we should all be wearing little lapel pins that identify ourselves as participating in this new vision of our society, that we are promoters of its cohesion and its intent to restore the institutions that we've had in the past that ensured our relative, at least, freedom of movement and speech and religion and all those freedoms that we used to prize. I think we should recognize that they've never been perfect, and in fact, they've often been illusory, but they were worthwhile goals. And while we had those goals, we could aspire to incarnating them. But unless we get a new sense of, I get national purpose, I mean, you have to have that. You have to have a sense of community that extends to the borders of your society. And with that, there would be some hope staving off the onslaughts on our freedom that are coming at us like waves on the ocean.
This country's not going to be saved from the top, because that's where all the rot is. It's too deep. It's going to be saved from the grassroots.